This is Ted Forbes, Australian Society for the Study of Labour History, talking to Des Heaney, past Secretary of ADSTI, and also of the Australian Amalgamated Australian Engineering. What was the name of this thing?
The union I joined through amalgamation was the Metals Engineering Workers Union, which is now called the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union.
That's right, good, right. Yeah. And now Des is working in industrial relations in a consultant capacity. Des, when did you join a union first? How old were you? And where was it?
I joined when I was about 19, and I came back from Israel and began psych nursing at Callan Park in Sydney, and joined the Health Nurses Association. Was the first union I joined.
Right. Well, that was one. What about other unions did you
Because they had dual coverage of nurses with the HREA at the time, now called the HSUA.
Well, that was HAREA, wasn't it?
HAREA. Mm. I joined HAREA because it was a more go-ahead union, and joined that union and became active in it.
And how long did you arrived in Canberra, and you came to Canberra about 82, 83, did you?
That's right. Before then, I had, as a senior registered nurse in Callan Park, I became the secretary of the HAREA subcommittee, which was a very localised branch of the union, and was extremely active at the hospital. In fact, we were the first psychiatric hospital in 30 years to actually have a total walkout of nursing staff.
Well, one of the questions was, were you a workplace delegate before you became an officer? I guess that'll do for that. Were you it's a sub-branch secretary, was it? A local, like the American term.
Well, very much like the American system, where you had you would negotiate with the secretaries of departments of health about problems affecting your areas. And I became so interested in that, and at the same time became less interested in and enjoying psych nursing. So from there, I got a position as an organiser with the Australian Theatrical and Amusement Employees Association in Sydney, at which I worked for about 3 years, looking after television, opera, race courses, outdoor workers.
Oh, right. I didn't know you did that. Okay, now how did you find your way down here?
Well,
you became an officer. You were an officer when you came here, weren't you?
I was a
How did you become an officer of ADSTI, wasn't it then?
What it was is I was a organiser with the Australian Theatrical Amusement Employees in Sydney, and they'd gone through a massive election campaign and defeat of the incumbent secretary, to which I was aligned. And whilst working under the new federal secretary, the tensions between the organising staff and the elected officials was such that it became politically untenable, and I was made aware of a position being vacant in ADSTI Canberra, and contacted the then secretary of ADSTI, Donna Valentine, and was successful in being appointed as a industrial officer with that union, on the basis that I would be an industrial officer for 2 weeks and then appointed secretary. That 2 weeks was effectively a handover between myself and Donna Valentine.
Ah, so she handed that over to you. You didn't defeat her.
No. I was employed as an industrial officer with the expectation within 2 weeks I'd be the appointed secretary.
Right. Okay. Why did you leave the union?
Well, having worked for so long, nearly 17 years as a union official, and then subsequently the secretary of the metalworkers in Canberra, the situation between our branch, the autonomy guaranteed to our branch under the amalgamation plan, was breached by George Campbell, the then federal secretary of the metalworkers, by virtue of him centralising all the funds and decision making in Sydney, and not allowing our branch to continue to act autonomously. And him not replacing resources, lost resources, I took the decision that it simply wasn't worth the internal political fight because we never would have the numbers, and more importantly, I could never deliver the level of service to those rank and file members that I thought was necessary. So I took a decision to resign, and once that was known in the office, the whole office decided to resign, and so we went into private practice, as we say.
Yeah, we might like to come back to that. At the end of the questions, I've got one question on the creation of the 20 super unions, and perhaps that might be apposite to touch on that again. Did you have political affiliations during the time you were active as an official?
I was always a member of the Labor Party, but not a particularly active one, only active to the extent that it was necessary as a union official to be active. I've never thought that the politicians or the political wing of the Labor movement was all that effective and beneficial to the Labor movement itself.
Right, but you were a member of the Labor Party right throughout, or...?
Since I was 16.
Oh, right. Political affiliations didn't change during this time. It was always the Labor Party, it was not in another...
No, it was always the Labor Party.
Oh, okay, good. And you were a family man with children during this time as a being official?
Yes, from Sydney. We had our first child in Sydney, so I had been a family man from the start of being an active full-time official.
Oh, okay. All right. Did union work affect your family life?
I think it had, in retrospect, and you become very caught up in your union work to the extent that you don't realise the impact it's having until you stop doing it. And I think my family paid a fairly high price in terms of my absence, and when I was there, the degree of tiredness that the job creates. Yes, I think we did pay a price for...
Is your family, you feel that they did miss out on something? Do they feel that... Are they conscious of that, or is it just a feeling you've got? Have you discussed it with? Do they regret that?
The answer is yes to both. Though, particularly my wife resented the amount of time and energy, particularly the amount of energy that the job took out of you, and the constant early starts and late arrivals at home, particularly when the children were very young. But by the same token, having stopped, their attitude had changed a bit. Having stopped being a union official, they noticed the change in me in terms of being available a lot more, but not having the
hassles,
but also that sort of not having the sense of job satisfaction and involvement that that job created. So it was both a benefit and a disadvantage.
Right, yeah. Des, did you present matters or get involved in matters before the Industrial Relations Commission or the Federal Court?
Yeah, I'd been to the Federal Court about half a dozen times. In terms of the commission, it was one of the few aspects of the job that I thoroughly enjoyed. The theatre, presenting a case, the sharp end of argument before a third party and trying to win it on merit was a very exhilarating experience, and that's one part that I do actually miss.
Right. Of course, the question here about the Federal Court, we would have only gone to the Federal Court as witnesses, wouldn't we? We usually...
No, I've taken two federal secretaries to the Federal Court in my time over perceived breaches of the rules.
And led the matter?
No, we've had, in the Federal Court, we had barristers leading the matter. But,
yes. That's what I say. It's a court, isn't it? And you can't lead.
No, you must be represented by a legally qualified counsel.
That's right. Yes, I've been in the court. I think it was called the, what was it called then? Industrial Court.
Industrial Court,
and
that's
I
right.
went as a witness, yes. As a full-time official... what role and responsibility did you have in determining union policy and practice?
A very, very significant role in terms of being Secretary of ADSTI and the Metalworkers in the Territory. Effectively, one wouldn't like to say it, but a near dictatorial role on the basis that the approving bodies, the branch councils, seem to be their views and aspirations very clearly linked to mine. So, because there was that very sympathetic and close relationship, as Secretary you could determine policies quite extensively. It changed dramatically when you moved to the national level, because the national priorities were not so clearly directed to rank and file outcomes, but more macro-political outcomes.
Could I ask you to think again about your use of the word dictatorial there, when you've gone on to say that, you know, you knew your branch council or your local branch council very well, that you saw a lot of them. Is that the fact that you're in in step so much with the group of people that you meet often? Does that suggest that there's anything dictatorial?
Oh, not
if in fact you just seem to agree.
Well, I take your point on that. Probably it is not dictatorial in that sense, but the ability to make decisions autonomously was there because they were always made against a background of knowing what the branch council could do or wouldn't do in a certain matter. And one of the benefits of working for a union, particularly like ADSTI and the metal workers when it did have its autonomy, was that you were actually talking to the people who would live under those and work under those decisions that you and the council made. So that closeness, which is not there now, was very much a great asset.
Yes, I know the feeling. I thought I had it myself in my own job. Do you believe that the 13 years of a Labor government was a help or a hindrance to the trade union movement? And I suppose what we're saying there, we would probably be putting some emphasis on the accord.
I think it's been a dramatic assistance in terms of, with a Liberal government or a Conservative government, the Labor movement would never got into place. Those very essential changes like superannuation for employees, occupational health and safety legislation, maternity leave legislation, those acts that only a federal government can put into place. There is an absolutely undeniable benefit of having the Labor government there. But if I was being absolutely honest about the long-term results, I think 13 years of Labor, coupled with the close relationship with the ACTU, has actually been a disadvantage because it has taken away the need for organisers to organise at the workplace has effectively made them lazy.
It's made the whole movement lazy, do you think?
Oh, I think it made them complacent. It took away the skills of those new... It didn't develop the skills in the new organisers coming through within those 13 years. The requirement to have the skills to organise, the ideological background was something that people didn't necessarily develop in themselves, but they took it on as a mantle. And I don't think therefore held it very coherently or sensibly. And effectively the leadership of the Labor movement, in my view, Kelty particularly, lost track of the day-to-day price organisers had to pay to organise Labor, and lost that very sharp analysis as to what your average member wants out of a trade union.
You seem to be addressing my next question, and I'll give it to you, but you can just continue on. What do you believe was the role and the result of the ACTU involvement in determining trade union policy and practice during that time that I alluded to before the 13 years?
I think they had an incredibly powerful influence and essentially a very negative one, because the role of many federal officers of unions, and therefore the role of the ACTU, because they made up the ACTU, decision-making body, and Kelty themselves, took an organisational view of unions as opposed to an industrial view. They were more concerned about creating efficient organisations across a broad front rather than efficient organisations representing their membership. And the power that large organisations gave those officials, and therefore Kelty, became too much a driving force.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Effectively, to answer that, the organisations became more important than what the organisations were designed to do.
Yeah, all right. What effect did the push for enterprise bargaining have on your union, both for the union officers and the rank and file, and what was its impact on your membership numbers and your method of organising?
Enterprise bargaining had a remarkably detrimental, I believe in the long term, a very detrimental effect in terms of, I don't think people really understood what it meant. I think there was and still is a lot of rhetoric about the issues. I don't believe your average organiser was skilled up enough to be able to bargain successfully at the enterprise level. I don't believe the organisations, the union movement itself, was resourced up sufficiently, because enterprise bargaining demands a massive net increase in resources to be able to put it into place successfully. And effectively, I don't believe the employers themselves were particularly skilled or knowledgeable in knowing what they wanted out of industrial relations. Enterprise bargaining's fundamental flaw is that it has an arrogant position of assuming industrial relations is one of the driving forces within a business, where in effect that's not the case. We gave it an undue influence and profile, and couldn't meet the demands that that profile created.
Well, you've already said there that union officials... My next question was, were union officials suitably skilled and resourced to handle decentralised bargaining? And was training given to them to cope with the change? You've half answered that already, but perhaps you didn't completely answer it. Did the union at any stage, even if latterly, attempt to give organisers and branch officers the training to enable them to...
Some would say yes, I would say no. The training that we got, and I understand other officials got, was one of the ideology and the conceptual background to enterprise bargaining, which unto itself is necessary. But what it didn't do is to give industrial and organising staff the skill to be able to effectively sit down and read a balance sheet. If you're going to bargain at an enterprise, you have to understand the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe your average union official either had the time, resources, and in many cases the intellect to be able to sit down, pull apart an organisation and rebuild it in industrial terms to make it more efficient. They simply didn't understand the concepts in an entrepreneurial sense as to what they were dealing with.
Apropos your reference to balance sheets and the capacity to read them, I have heard it said that balance sheets are not interesting actually for the things that they reveal, but the things that they don't reveal. The great skill is in interpreting a balance sheet.
Well, that's right, and I can't. The
things they hide, I should say.
I can't understand how one can bargain at the enterprise unless you understand that detail. And the average organiser neither had the time, resources, or training to do so.
You have to know how they're going, don't you?
That's right.
You have to have. Do you mean that you assess their capacity to pay?
And that, and also one of the other things of enterprise bargaining that people didn't really take on board, and I don't think many people understand, is that what the ACTU and the metalworkers, through people like George Campbell, were saying, is that we actually have to help businessmen run their businesses to be more efficient, so we can get more wage increases and job security. Now, what that does in a very practical sense is that an organiser has to be a de facto member of the board of directors, and that creates a perceptional problem between him and he or her and his rank and file. Now, I don't think your average rank and file member really understood the need to be that close to management to do a good deal. They saw it in some ways as being collaborative.
Well, was management skilled enough to bargain effectively at the site level during this?
Well, I must have, my view on that before I left the metalworkers was that, yes, they were. That they were successful insofar as that we found it hard to get what we perceived to be decent wage increases. But having worked as a private industrial relations consultant for the last 3 years, I now realise that in the main, most managers were as disorganised in terms of their approach to industrial relations as most union organisers were, and paid very scant attention. Now, I tend to believe that the parties themselves, as Fulbent's decision in 1991 said, the parties simply weren't mature enough to handle the debate.
Well, do you think that decentralised bargaining enhanced the relationship between you and your members, or the unionist members, or did it distance them during the time that you were there?
In some circumstances, where you were successful, it was, and where you had, given the premise that you had sufficient resources to do the bargaining properly, i.e., you just didn't skirt across the issues and then get from one workplace to the next, if you accept that you had enough resources to do it properly within each enterprise, it did increase the bond between the official and the rank and file. But the reality is there was never enough time and resources to really do that job properly. And it meant your average delegate had to take on a net additional role that many of them couldn't afford to do in terms of time. And many of them simply didn't want to. At the end of the day, I'd have to say your average union activist has been burnt out by the demands created by enterprise bargaining.
Well, that's an interesting statement. Yes. Decentralised bargaining reduced the relevance of the award system. That's a statement. What do you think about that statement?
Well, as a political answer, I mean, I've held the view for quite a number of years and argued it through national level at the metalworkers to great criticisms of myself, is that effectively it's my belief that Kelty and Keating have been responsible for the demise of the award system. They have encouraged enterprise bargaining to the extent that the award is now something people don't even regard as a document worth enforcing, because the site-based deals have moved away so much from the award, or the award has not been kept up to date, to the extent that we now no longer have that broad front ability to bring up those workplaces that haven't bargained well or haven't bargained at all by use of the award, because the award has been effectively made industrially redundant. Now, I believe the accord can be held responsible for that.
What do you believe are the reasons behind the declining rates of union membership? What, in your view, needs to be done to rectify this decline?
If you're going to take unions out of the industry focus and put them more in a workplace focus, it's axiomatic that the unions have to be closer to the rank and file and have the time and resources to do that. I don't believe that's the case, as I've said earlier. What it's actually done is created the situation whereby... Can I have that question, the first part of the question again?
Yeah, what do you believe are the reasons behind the declining rates of union membership?
Right.
And what needs to be done to fix it?
It's the demise of the award in some ways is correlated to the demise of being ideologically driven within unions. Very few unions now are ideologically based or coherently based in terms of being able to say, yes, I know what that union stands for. What that means is there's a lot less, and society's changed dramatically as well, there's no doubt about that. There's very few ideologically committed trade unionists. So many trade union members now members of their trade union and the NRMA for the same reasons. One is principally of insurance, protection. Mm. Now, which means you simply weren't getting that throughput at the delegate level to organise labour on the union's behalf at the worksite. More was relied on the union official, who simply had less and less time to devote to that. And my strongest criticism of the Kelty plan and the federal secretaries of big unions who were also part of this, they ceased to realise that the union had to be part of the community. They thought industrial relations was such a big issue and such an important social event that it should exist in its own right. The fundamental flaw in the last 10 years of trade unions is that they have distanced themselves from the community in which they work. They aren't seen by the community as a normal, viable, essential part of being in the workforce. They are regarded as specialist and isolationist, and they have isolated themselves from the community generally. And I think that's a very high price that can't be paid.
Well, perhaps you might... this next question might be tied in with that previous one. The ACTU plan for the creation of 20 super unions is now complete, or nearly complete anyway. What's your view of the change? Has it fulfilled expectations of applying greater resources and efficiencies into the trade union movement? What effect did it have on you as an official? And how do you think it was received by the rank and file, your membership?
I think there were far too many unions. So many of those unions simply didn't have the capacity to do their job properly. There's no doubt about that. And they had outlived their usefulness. But having said that, I don't believe the the current situation of having 20 or 22 super units was the answer, because the way they were organised was done too much on a political basis rather than what their rank and the nature of the work that their members did. The AWU fine was a classic example. The issue of the 20 super unions rose or fell on the basis that they would be more effective organisationally. I believe, particularly after working in the metalworkers for quite a number of years, the fundamental flaw there was that whilst they created these large organisations, they didn't create the knowledge and expertise within the union movement to be able to run those organisations well. Effectively, and on no disrespect to the individuals involved, you had boilermakers running multi-million dollar organisations who had no managerial or administrative expertise at all. And I don't believe that was an effective use of the resources. The other major problem was, and we didn't realise that until quite deeply into the process, that we had alienated our rank and file, particularly that skill, that rank and file that were based on skill. They felt that their particular skills, rightly or wrongly, were so special that only they and a specialised union could look after them. And I think the super unions showed no sympathy or empathy with that position and typically subsumed those craft-based aspirations into a generalist union, and by doing that, alienated their membership. A point there would be, Ted, that the metal workers is a classic example. ADSTI was a technical engineering-based, science-based union for para-professionals and above. We amalgamated with a trade-based union where our branch and the Tasmanian branch were instrumental in opposing that amalgamation, not the creation of a super union, but the super union on the basis of an industry that many of our members didn't see themselves in. We wanted to create a super union based on a horizontal cut across industry, i.e. of technical officers, because we believe that your average member didn't see themselves primarily as working in a particular industry. They saw themselves having a particular type of skill that they could transport to any industry. And if we had been successful in getting the super union based on technical workers as opposed to an industry base, it would have been a far more successful operation.
Oh, that was your view at the time, 5 or 6 years ago. And do you think that history bears you out? And
I think it does, surprisingly, that now that we're involved in, and quite frankly, paid by employers to give advice, but we go around and talk to a lot of union members and a lot of delegates and a lot of staff, what we see now is the natural organics within a workplace of staff are now, with or without unions, organising themselves within workplaces based on their skill profile. Technical officers are getting together. Science workers are getting together. They aren't seeing themselves necessarily as organising themselves within the industry in which they may work, but around their craft or skill. And we're noticing that informal organising taking on a much higher and rapid profile.
Right. Des, if you were still a union official, what bargaining system would you prefer to work in?
I think, and I must sound very conservative going to say this, but I actually believe the most effective form of bargaining is on the basis of free market IR. That means you get what you can get. Now, people say that doesn't allow widespread application of results. Well, if you look at the effect of enterprise bargaining, there's a very large and significant proportion of workers in Australia who have not got an increase through enterprise bargaining but the $8 safety net. So I don't believe enterprise bargaining has been more universally applied and successful than free market industrialisation.
All right. This is a philosophic question, Des. Would you be pleased if one of your children was interested in becoming a union official? Without goading from you, if they came along at a later stage and said, "Hey, Dad, been offered a job on the union, I'm going to take it."
Oh, I'd be very pleased. I'd be very pleased. I mean,
why?
Well, I suppose the union movement that I joined no longer exists. But the union movement my daughter or my son might join, for them would be sufficient, you know, would be quite relevant and the correct thing to support. I suppose I'd be pleased for two things. From a personal point of view, there is very few jobs that would give you the range of experiences and pack them into a very short period of time that a union organiser has. Remarkably, there you see parts of life as a union official that your average person would never see, let alone understand. So I think it's a great developmental position. And on top of that, I think unions are, good unions, and there should be made a distinction between good and bad unions, good unions are very effective organisations in representing employers. And I believe whether people are members of a union or not, they need representation, they need assistance. And to have an organisation there to do that effectively and have a, one of my children part of that, I'd be very pleased.
That's good, man. Are there any other comments you'd like to make? Anything you think that we've missed?
I suppose the hardest thing for the trade union movement is, going back to that earlier comment about lack of service. My view has always been that the metal workers should base themselves on an organisation like the NRMA. Why do people join the NRMA? Mm. They're not ideologically committed. They join it because there's a service. I believe, and it's very, very sad to see, so few people in unions or joining unions because the major criticism being they don't offer a service or an efficient service. And to see employees frustrated and sometimes abused in workplaces and not have the capacity for them to have those problems resolved is very sad.
As one of the interviewees said, or was suggested that needs more of the union organiser and less of the labour manager.
I think that's very true. That's very true. But I don't see it changing.
No.
I think over time, unions appropriate to the circumstances will be recreated.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Des. All right then.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Des.